in the second book of Samuel, chapter 18, and reading from the 19th verse, and on for a little bit into the 19th chapter. Following Absalom's death, 2 Samuel 18 and 19. Now Ahimaaz, son of Zadok, the priest, said, "Let me run and take the news to the king that the Lord has delivered him from the hand of his enemies." "You are not the one to take the news today," Joab told him. "You may take the news another time, but you must not do so today, because the king's son is dead." Then Joab said to a Cushite, "Go tell the king what you have seen." The Cushite bowed down before Joab and ran off. Ahimaaz, son of Zadok, again said to Joab, "Come what may, please let me run behind the Cushite." But Joab replied, "My son, why do you want to go? You don't have any news that will bring you a reward." He said, "Come what may, I want to run." So Joab said, "Run." Then Ahimaaz ran by way of the plain and outran the Cushite. While David was sitting between the inner and outer gates of Mahanaim, the watchman went up to the roof of the gateway by the wall. As he looked out, he saw a man running alone. The watchman called out to the king and reported it. And the king said, "If he is alone, he must have good news." And the man came closer and closer. Then the watchman saw another man running, and he called down to the gatekeeper, "Look, another man running alone." The king said, "He must be bringing good news too." The watchman said, "It seems to me that the first one runs like Ahimaaz, son of Zadok." "He's a good man," the king said. "He comes with good news." Then Ahimaaz called out to the king, "All is well." He bowed down before the king with his face to the ground and said, "Praise be to the Lord your God. He has delivered up the men who lifted their hands against my lord the king." The king asked, this was all that was in his mind, "Is the young man Absalom safe?" Ahimaaz answered, "I saw great confusion just as Joab was about to send the king's servant and me, your servant, but I don't know what it was." The king said, "Stand aside and wait here." So he stepped aside and stood there. Then the Cushite arrived and said, "My lord the king, hear the good news. The Lord has delivered you today from all who rose up against you." The king asked the Cushite, "Is the young man Absalom safe?" The Cushite replied, "May the enemies of my lord the king and all who rise up to harm you be like that young man." The king was shaken. He went up to the room over the gateway and wept. And as he went, he said, "Oh, my son Absalom, my son Absalom, if only I had died instead of you. Oh, Absalom, my son, my son." Joab was told, "The king is weeping and mourning for Absalom. And for the whole army, the victory that day was turned into mourning, because on that day, the troops heard it said, 'The king is grieving for his son.' The men stole into the city that day, as men steal in who are ashamed when they flee from battle. The king covered his face and cried aloud, 'Oh, my son Absalom, oh, Absalom, my son, my son.'" Then Joab went into the house to the king and said, Today you have humiliated all your men who have just saved your life and the lives of your sons and daughters and the lives of your wives and concubines. You love those who hate you and hate those who love you. You have made it clear today that the commanders and their men mean nothing to you. I see that you would be pleased if Absalom were alive today and all of us were dead. Now, go out and encourage your men. I swear by the Lord that if you do not go out, not a man will be left with you by nightfall. This will be worse for you than all the calamities that have come upon you from your youth till now. So the king got up and took his seat in the gateway. When the men were told, "The king is sitting in the gateway," they all came before him. Amen. May God bless to us his most holy word. The Old Testament, the second book of Samuel, chapter 18, from the 19th verse to chapter 19, verse 8. Today in the lesson we read, we see something of the sentimental sickness of a great man. And it is almost stupefying to consider it. But then, history is strewn with the strange stories of the weaknesses of the great, which may baffle understanding, especially if we are not aware of the subtleties of the tempter, who is a master at exploring and exploiting the vulnerabilities of the great in their times of weakness. One of the amazing things one soon discovers in reading biographies is the startling inconsistencies of even the most illustrious souls. I have been reading a biography of Field Marshal Lord Montgomery, and the variations in that great man's opinions and behavior would be exceedingly bewildering if we simply believed that human nature acts on its own. It doesn't. What do I mean? Well, how could it, when two worlds of the spirit impinge on men, good and evil, whether men are aware of them or not? Men are more often moved by someone or something beyond them than they know. The story of how the news of Absalom's death came to David is exciting. Didn't you find it so as we read it? They all wanted to bring him the good news of his men's victory over Absalom's men. But the only thing that David wanted to hear, almost more than that his side had prevailed, which is astounding, isn't it? The only thing David wanted to hear was that the young man Absalom was safe. No way, David, no way. But Joab knew how it would affect David to learn that Absalom was dead. And so he seemed to dread to tell him. And he certainly didn't want those who were over-eager with the good news of victory to barge in tactlessly. And in answer to the one question David would ask them, is the young man safe? Say, he's dead. Think of the insensitivity of that Cushite. Of all the fools, never afraid to tread where angels wouldn't, this one was the worst and the grossest. What a blundering ass he was. If he had had any idea of the excitement within David's breast as he heard of men running while he tried to determine whether they brought good news or ill, the Cushite would have taken thought of whether he would divulge to David that his son was dead. For David seems to have been simply pinning his faith on good news about his son, never mind what happened to the army. No, David, no. You're barking up the wrong tree. You are assuming that Absalom would ride safely through the forest, avoiding the thickets, and emerge into the open safe and well. But it was not to be. You, David, indeed decided that the battle should be joined in the forest. Did you know, David, that there were those low-growing oaks there with underhanging branches? In fact, did you, David, therefore contribute to your son's death by your command to the army to engage the battle in the forest? And if so, David, do you now see not only the irony of what happened, but there was a certain predestination in it, that this rebellious youth was predestined to die for the enormity of his offense in seeking to push his divinely appointed father off his throne. But none of that weighed with David, for he was now a sick old man. And it's almost incredible to believe that such a character had reduced himself veritably to an emotional pulp over the welfare of his wayward boy, so nothing else in the whole world seemed to matter, even his own return to the throne, as long as this young rascal was safe. And there was David in the strange city of Mahanaim, in the most uncertain circumstances, surrounded by all the evidences of his hasty flight and his al fresco plight, and the future of the kingdom being decided. And all that David has a mind to was the safety of Absalom. And when he heard, his grief was so altogether unsupportable that he wanted no one, if possible, to know how deeply it cut into the fibers of his emotional being, so that he repaired to an inner sanctum and wept his heart out as he cried uncontrollably, "O Absalom! My son Absalom, would I had died for thee." Isn't that a great sickness in so great a man, at the very moment when his flight and plight were about to be reversed, and he would be able to return to Jerusalem to resume his kingship. But it didn't seem to touch him, only Absalom. But of course it was known, although the king tried to hide it, it was known that the king was shattered and devastated by the news of Absalom's death, and that he refused to be controlled. But the news soon reached the soldiers, and all these men who had pursued Absalom's army, returning from this strange battle in the woods in triumph, were being told, "Hush! Don't say a word about victory, boys. Not a word. We have actually suffered a great defeat today, despite all the evidences of the rout of Absalom's forces. We have suffered a great defeat today because the boy is dead, and nothing in the whole wide world matters compared with that awful news to our king." And whatever the culpability of Joab in, you remember, virtually murdering the young man, and Joab had already the guilt of Abner's death on his conscience, which, you remember, grieved Uncle David so deeply. I say, whatever the culpability of Joab in virtually murdering Absalom, there is no doubt that Joab saw and spoke straight to David that day, and realized that Uncle David had practically taken leave of his senses. Now, Joab was a very brave man. We have seen evidence of that. He had, I believe, some of the qualities of his uncle David, but not the divine anointing, so that although he couldn't possibly see things the way David did, Job's was the mind and voice of sanity in that situation. In fact, Israel's whole world was being upturned. But the reality of the victory was virtually turned into defeat on account of this one thing, that the cause of all the trouble, Absalom, was dead, which was really the purpose of the exercise, of the battle. But nothing could have hurt David more than that, nothing, even the loss of the kingdom. Now, do you see how contradictory the whole thing is? Why, when David sent out his troops to the battle and cried after them, "Take care of Absalom," David was as split a personality as ever was. What did he think in his confused state? That his army would gain ascendancy over Absalom's army, but that somehow the young man himself would be preserved safe, even if he was still adamantly against his father coming back to Jerusalem, or even remaining alive. David wanted Absalom to be safe and preserved, even although he knew that there was nothing that the wicked young man desired so much as his father's death. So do you see how mixed up even the greatest personalities can become when that which is itself legitimate human love is allowed to boil up and then degenerate into such a vile stupor that it becomes fixated enough to see its emotional obsession fill its whole horizon and at last filled the whole world and the universe until one sees nothing else. So that nothing matters any longer in the whole wide world but this overriding passion. Well, you see, this is to turn sanity and good sense on its head until nothing but the tortured emotions of one man prevails in the kingdom. And the whole of life is turned into a sheer slough and sludge of despond. If ever there was a scenario which proclaimed the enemy's vile influence on a national situation, this is it. And yet, the curious thing is, it is a consideration which I must admit preoccupies my mind quite a lot as I review the life and work of David. The curious thing is that the last thing the whole narrative ever mentions or seems to be aware of is the very enemy Satan, who is obviously churning up all this muck and ruining the prospects of God's specially chosen kingdom of Israel. The shadow, the dark shadow of the enemy is very, very plain throughout these books, the Samuel's first and second Samuel. Do you see that? Or in the Bible reading notes which I've just commenced in the book of Job, if you leave out the first two chapters, not until the end, and even then, not explicitly, is there any reference to Satan. But you're very, very spiritually blind if you don't see him. That's what I say about those who have a particular interpretation of Romans chapter 7, that unless you are able to put a D at the beginning of the word evil in Romans 7:23, I don't think you've understood what's going on, the nature of the conflict in the heavenlies. But as I say, it is into this confused situation that the brave Job enters, and with his head fairly and firmly screwed on, he proceeds to deal with his distracted uncle David. And he makes a good job of it too, sufficient to make David think and then act with a view to returning to normality again at Jerusalem. So Job says to David virtually, "You see what you have done, Uncle David? You have humiliated your men by your sickly grief on the day when they have saved your life and the life of all your household and entourage. The fact is that you have shown that you love those who hate you and hate those who love you." Now, that's a sentence, isn't it? Didn't it take some courage to say that? To bring out what could have brought out better than these words, the contradictory nature of David's sickly love for his now thoroughly despised and deceased son. And Job goes on, "You have shown by the perverse prejudice of your preference for Absalom that your men mean nothing to you, and that you would be better pleased if all of us were dead as long as Absalom were alive. It's got to stop, David. These men are almost on the point of deserting you, as absolutely disgusted with what they have heard of your mourning for the death of your enemy. You'd better get up and get out and face these men before you lose them, because if you don't, you won't have a man with you by nightfall. And that, my dear uncle, will be worse for you than all the calamities that you have thus suffered, to have the whole of your Israelite army, which have been with you in all your conquests, turn against you. So David got up and went out and sat in the gate in view of his people, in the hope of restoring their morale and affording them opportunities to speak with him and discuss what should now be done. But it was a near shave, wasn't it? Indeed, the people in general throughout the land were confused and were arguing with one another as to what was to happen now. The king has been driven out and his son had taken over, but now the son is dead and his hope is gone. Who is in charge and who is going to rule over us? And so the cry began to go up from the people. When are they going to bring the king back? And indeed, David himself sent a message to the priests and the elders of Judah. What are you thinking about, you people of my own tribe of Judah, that you should be the last to think of bringing the king back to his palace? But then, who was to lead the army? For you see, although David had heeded his nephew Joab's warning, David undoubtedly would have heard that it was Joab who virtually slew Absalom. So, as far as the leader of the army is concerned, Joab was now out. And it was his cousin, Amasa, who had led Absalom's forces, who was chosen to lead the army. And so the men of Judah, to a man, agreed and conspired to go out and fetch the king back again to his capital city. And so the story goes on. But we've had enough of it for today. But the lesson is undoubtedly how perversely sick this great man David became over his wayward son, which went so far as to turn his head until he was working absolutely against his own best interests. He had this youngster on such a pedestal that he would have sacrificed the welfare of the whole nation just to preserve Absalom alive. And you see what that means. It means that what we call human love, which in its rightful place is a beautiful thing, and undoubtedly comes from God, can become so diseased and rotten that it can turn not only a man's head, but his heart into a cesspool of iniquity, and cause him so to desert sanity and reason that he contradicts all the dictates of good government. So, what is our safeguard against that sickly love? For you see, if that could happen to a giant of human stature like David, it could happen to you and to me, so that all our plans for the glory of God could be turned into ruin and disaster, and all because a legitimate human love had become sick and diseased and perverse and wicked. So there is only one answer to the danger, and it is surely to superimpose upon such hazardous love, to superimpose a superior love, which is absolutely safe. And all know what love that is, don't we? The love of Jesus, as the hymn says, what it is, none but his loved ones know. But the trouble often is, you know, that we who are loved with that everlasting love don't in fact know how much he loves us and how far that love can transform our other loves in order to keep them right and in their proper place. Jesus first, others next, yourself last of all. That's the acrostic for the word joy. Jesus first, others next, yourself last of all. And yet, you know, there's more to it than that, important though that is. The sickest love of all is not necessarily love of another. You know what's coming. But love of self. Love of self. Of the three hymn books we use here, not one of them has the hymn which meant a very great deal to me in my young day. I wonder if you know it. It begins, "Oh, the bitter shame and sorrow that a time could ever be, when I let the Savior's pity plead in vain and proudly answered, all of self and none of thee." The next verse says, "Yet he found me, I beheld him bleeding on the accursed tree, heard him pray, forgive them, Father. And my wistful heart said faintly, some of self and some of thee." The third verse, "Day by day his tender mercy, healing, helping, full and free, sweet and strong and so patient, brought me lower while I whispered less of self and more of thee." The last verse, "Higher, higher than the highest heaven, deeper than the deepest sea, Lord, thy love at last has conquered. Grant me now my spirit's longing, none of self and all of thee." But you see, it is basically self-love which loves others in a sick and sentimental way that are no help at all to anyone. None at all. We do people harm. We sometimes speak about people's kindness being killing. A delicate thing to say, but you see, that could happen when there is a sick love of another. How did we put it the other week? Our actions say, although I suppose we would never admit it, our actions say, "I love me and want you." Isn't there a lot of truth in that? I love me and want whatever else. But there is a love of Jesus which enables us to love others truly, healthfully, and in such a way that it creates a response in kind, until the love of Jesus becomes the rule of life of a whole family and of a whole congregation. And more. The father-in-law of Alistair Boole, who was assistant at New Hills for some time and is now down in Kilbarkin in Ayrshire, his father-in-law, Norman Cruikshank of Overton, West Kilbride, has come to the Crieff Conference for many years, and writing to me of the recent Crieff Conference, this is what he said. The talks were so helpful and encouraging, and the love and the concern felt among the folks such a blessing. And that's true. The love and concern felt among the folks such a blessing. The sharing at meals and at other times. You see, if the love of Jesus is spread abroad in this family fellowship, and then spreads out to the Crieff gatherings and the hundreds of fellowships at home and abroad represented by it, then the effect could be incalculable. Love spread abroad throughout many parts of the land and beyond. So what we say to ourselves now is, let this love grow in me and in you, and let's see if that doesn't in time do more to change our national church and, please God, our Scottish nation than all the excited talk about dramatic blessings. But as you know, it takes death to self, which I've just been quoting in the hymn. It takes death to self to accomplish this. But oh, how abundantly worthwhile it is to have this quality of safe love, pure love, Jesus love, emanating from us all. I first met Marjorie Sinton as a young divinity student and knew of her need. And after a year or two of friendship, she came and helped me with my aunt, who was with me in the manse then, for many years. And her boys became to me like my sons. And I believe it was the love that she found here and brought her boys to that has shone so brightly in the life of our daily loved brother. The other day I sat by his bedside in hospital while Ian Wiseman, the minister at Port Seton, was visiting him. And James and Ian were great friends. James went across to Lewis to his wedding. And as I sat, James spoke of his faith to Ian most beautifully, most wonderfully, and it thrilled my heart. The love of Jesus, what it is, none but his loved ones know.